Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Thanks so much for joining us every week. We hope that you check out the archives as well as the links that we have to our guests' websites. The information that they have to offer, I think, is invaluable. Take what you need, leave the rest. We put out a smorgasbord, and we don't expect you to eat it all. That would be foolish. All in moderation, as my father used to say. All in moderation. But try different things. What could it hurt? I guarantee you it won't. Today's going to be interesting because we're going to take a look at a subject that we've delved into a number of times on this program, as well as in a movie that I just most recently saw. We'll get into that in a moment, but first let's talk about our guest, who is the author of the book Evidence of Eternity, Communicating with Spirits for Proof of the Afterlife. And what better person to talk to than a lawyer? You'd think, well, that's very strange to have a lawyer on your program. Ah, this is no ordinary lawyer, Your Honor. This is a psychic lawyer. His name is Mark Anthony. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to be here.
You know, I had an opportunity, of course, to obviously seek out and find a lot of the videos and information that's available about you and what you do and the work that you do. I have to say that it reminded me of an old Woody Allen joke about his time in college and how he took Metaphysics 101 and he failed the final because he was accused of cheating. He was accused of looking into the soul of the student next to him.
That's hysterical.
So there you go. Now, according to the information I have here, this is the first book of its kind. It is, of course, riveting and provocative, and you come to us with a law degree. You do practice, or you did practice law at one time, correct?
I'm a member of the Florida Bar, the Washington, D.C. Bar, and the United States Supreme Court Bar. I've been a prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney, a personal injury trial attorney, and I've litigated, probably 250 jury trials and represented at least 10,000 to 12,000 people in my practice. And my first book, Never Letting Go, came out 4 years ago and was a huge sensation. And I followed it up this March with Evidence of Eternity. And what's happened, Richard, is the demand for my services as an attorney have gotten to the point where I'm temporarily and possibly permanently putting my law practice on hold, although I still act as a legal consultant and as a legal analyst on high-profile criminal cases. Plus, I'm the go-to guy on several radio shows and TV shows nationwide for not only high-profile murders, but also cases where the paranormal and the legal system collide.
Well, and that's rather interesting because the legal system usually, at least from an idealistic perspective, that would be mine, is usually about looking at the facts in the case, the physical evidence, and coming to a conclusion. Now, that's the idealistic perspective, because what I've been seeing is that the legal system, as well as the judicial system, they don't care about the facts. They care about winning. At least that seems to be the perception that I'm getting from a lot of different corners, which is kind of sad because we find people who end up 10, 15, 20, 30 years later being let out of prison because DNA shows they didn't do it. And so you have to wonder if the people involved at the time were really interested in finding the truth, as opposed to just finding somebody they could nail, they could pin this particular crime on.
It's really sad when that happens.
Yeah.
There's an old saying that it's better for 10 guilty men to go free than for one innocent man to go to jail. And I tend to agree with that. And, you know, Winston Churchill said that our legal system, the Anglo-American system of jurisprudence, is the most inefficient, the most costly, the most time-consuming, but it's better than everything else humanity has tried.
What does he know? He's British.
Well, that's where we got our
I know that's where that's where we grew from
until proven guilty.
Yeah,
and it's very difficult when you're in the legal system and you see all the flaws with it.
Yeah,
because it seems that it's supposed to be about truth, justice, the American way, and all too often it seems to fall into who can outmaneuver who has more power, more leverage,
more money.
And that's very, very sad when that happens. And I've seen some absolutely revolting people walk scot-free, and I've also seen other people who were innocent get convicted. But in what I've been involved with in my cases and the cases I've tried, it really seems like both parties were earnestly trying to do what they're supposed to do, which is present the facts and evidence that that are most favorable to their side of the case.
True. And now, I myself never, ever thought I would be having to deal with the judicial system and needing a legal or counsel, and also never thought I would ever be sued in my life. And I've only been sued once, but it's called a divorce. I didn't know that at the time.
Well, there's the three rings of a relationship. There's the engagement ring, there's the wedding ring, and then there's the suffer ring, which occurs during a divorce. And it's really sad that, you know, you get involved with someone that you love so much, and then all those delightful things about him or her that one loves then become the most excruciatingly irritating things, and sometimes relationships crash and burn. But, you know, in having been raised as a pious Catholic, we were always taught that divorce is a sin, and now the Catholic Church has changed their position on that, because basically it's like, why should you be stuck with somebody you're absolutely miserable with?
Yeah.
And so that's where divorce comes along. And it's really sad. I've seen so many people go through such painful divorces. And it is. It's very difficult. And, you know, Richard, nobody wakes up one morning and says, gee, my life is great, I think I'll go to a lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't work that way.
But we are a necessary component of society, because contracts exist because people can't necessarily trust each other.
Oh.
And then when there becomes a dispute between people over money, or somebody commits a crime, the legal system gets involved. It reminds me of that movie, The Devil's Advocate, where Al Pacino, he was just great.
Oh, he was.
Canal
fabulous.
Reeves is, yeah, and Canal Reeves, you know, the young idealistic lawyer, and he says to Al Pacino, why the legal system? And Al Pacino says it the only way, and as only Al Pacino could do, because it puts us in everything.
That's true. It does. By the way, you used an interesting word that actually helps us to transition to our next segment in this conversation, contract. Now, many people in the spiritual and metaphysical communities have this, I don't know if I want to say belief or understanding, that before we come into this lifetime that we might be living, we, in a manner of speaking, we sign a contract, or we agree to a contract with certain terms and conditions for certain experiences in our lives, and then we come into this world and we can live those out, or, believe it or not, it's not ironclad, because we can actually sort of renegotiate on the fly and say, you know what, I really don't need to, I don't need to go through that. I'm not going to go through that, and so forth, which is kind of neat, because most contracts in the material world are pretty ironclad, and you better be sure of your wording in it before you decide you're going to quote-unquote breach it. But it's interesting, because I watched a movie that I was going to mention earlier, and you may have seen this since we're bringing up movies. It's fairly new, I believe, and it's called I, Origin. The letter I and Origin, and the basic premise surrounds the iris or biometrics, and how they're cataloging all these different people, and all of the sudden they go in and they look they want to look at a particular person's retina scan. And somebody else comes up with the identical retina scan. Now, my understanding is that the retinas of human beings are as distinct and different and unique as fingerprints.
Yes.
And yet this, and again, I don't know how much of this is science fiction and how much is reality, But what they were able to do is determine, this one woman died. They went in and they searched for this dead woman's iris pattern, and a little girl of 12 years old in India who had been scanned was in the system, and she had an identical iris pattern. And what basically the premise of the film seemed to be doing was, even if it was fiction, was sort of presenting a case for reincarnation.
Yes.
So when we're talking about evidence of eternity, and I mean, you know, we could sit here and talk about all of the different aspects and attributes of what we think eternity is, because part of that is reincarnation.
Yes.
Part of it is, some would say, multiple dimensions. Some would say different levels of, quote unquote, heaven and so forth. And I've even heard it said that in the next life, and I don't necessarily mean a reincarnation, but when I leave this physical body before I choose to come into another, that I am reunited with the One, the universal force, if you will, which is where we all came from, as some would understand it, and so forth. So in light of that hypothetical concept of the retina scan, what kind of evidence have you found that has made it clear to you that there is, in fact, not just an eternity, but maybe even some of these, what we might term as mythological or belief-based attributes of the hereafter?
Well, that's quite the complicated question. So now I'm turning into the lawyer. Let's take it step by step. First off, in my book, Evidence of Eternity, I address pretty much everything that you discussed in the question. I believe in reincarnation for a number of factors. And once again, these are things that I get into in great detail in Evidence of Eternity, which has been number one on the reincarnation bestseller list on Amazon since it was released March 8th. First off, in the thousands of readings that I've conducted, spirits come through, and occasionally during the contact, they will communicate certain things and respond to certain questions. And every time the topic of reincarnation has come up, they've indicated that that's the case. Well, that's nice. But then when I started doing in-depth study on near-death experiences, and my book has been endorsed by the top three near-death experience researchers in the world, and with near-death experiences, somebody dies, their consciousness separates from their body, they go into the light, they see people they know who have passed. And in the reason they call it near-death is because the soul, the spirit, returns to the body. All the NDE people believe in reincarnation. Then in my study of theology, which has spanned my entire lifetime because I had considered being a Catholic priest when I was younger but decided instead to go into law, that's a book in and of itself. But at the root of all of the major belief systems is reincarnation. Certainly the Buddhists and the Hindus, in the Chassidic sect of mystical Judaism, it discusses several lifetimes, which is indicative of a belief in reincarnation. In the New Testament, in Christianity, there's discussion between Jesus and his disciples of who do you say that I am, and I believe it's in the book of Matthew, and the disciples replied, well, some say that you are the prophet Elijah. Others say that you are John the Baptist. And then Jesus responds, Elijah has returned, but they did not recognize him, for he appeared in the form of John the Baptist. Now, Elijah lived something like 8 centuries before John the Baptist and Jesus. So many biblical scholars and many scholars from other religions who have analyzed these passages believe that this is an indication of reincarnation. But it gets even better than that, Richard, because in the early Christian era, reincarnation was part of Christianity. In fact, the great philosopher Origen of Alexandria, who lived in the second century, second, third century AD, wrote extensively about all souls having multiple existences and eventually all becoming one with God. In fact, he even said that even Satan can emerge from the darkness and eventually be reunited with God. And in the Fifth Ecumenical Council under the Byzantine/Roman Emperor Justinian the Great around 527-530 AD, reincarnation was officially removed from Christian doctrine, declared heresy, and then another version of the Bible was rewritten. I mean, we could sit here all day and go on about that.
Sure.
But also, in Evidence of Eternity, I present two cases that were investigated and documented, and one is considered to be the most highly documented case in modern history. It took place in the 1930s in India, involving a little girl by the name of Shanti Devi. And I don't want to give any spoiler alerts, but it's a really, really fascinating account. And the Indian government formed a commission, which Mahatma Gandhi headed up, and an independent third party, a Swedish journalist, analyzed the entire thing. And the conclusion was, this little girl had indeed lived before and gave enough facts and evidence to verify that. And so, and we're beginning to see now that there's more and more cases of the little boy who I think his last name is Lonergan, gave an account of being a pilot in World War II, shot down off of Japan, and then the fighter jet was located in the ocean off Japan, right where he said it would be. And so we're seeing now that reincarnation is an openly discussed topic. And at this point in human history, there are more people on this planet who believe in reincarnation than ever before.
You know, and it's interesting, too, that it's something that's a little more easily discussed than, let's say, the subject of aliens and UFOs. I would rather sit and talk to you about reincarnation all day long than get into that quagmire at this particular point, just simply because there is so much, at least it seems to me, there's so much more, not validity, that's the wrong word. It has more meaning, or can have more meaning to our present-day lives. It can help us to understand why we are the way we are and who we are than anything else, than any therapy one might go through, per se, because we then begin to understand, none of my relatives ever were interested in these subjects. Why am I? I mean, you know, because we're products of our genetics in a very big way in that regard. But we don't fully understand all that. And then all of a sudden you start throwing reincarnation in there and going, oh, in a past life I was, that makes perfect sense. And things just start to click for us.
A lot of very prominent people throughout history have believed in reincarnation, such as Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Motor Company. General George S. Patton was a firm believer in reincarnation. Now, can you think of two more no-nonsense guys?
Oh, yeah.
than
I mean,
them?
Come on.
And you know, and it's not only Democrats believe in reincarnation. No, a lot of Republicans, a lot of everybody, a lot of Christians are now saying that this makes more sense. And what I do in Evidence of Eternity is it's not just my personal experiences in spirit communication, but I also combined science, theoretical physics, human physiology, in addition to theology and evidence, to present the questions and the issues and the proof for the reader. So when we look to the laws of physics, the second law of thermodynamics teaches us that energy is neither created nor destroyed, only transferred from one form to another. Every religious system, every belief system since the ancient Hindus, the ancient Egyptians, through the Chinese, through the Greeks, the Romans, Christianity, Islam, Native Americanism, animism in Africa, teaches us that the soul, the energy that is a person, pre-exists the body and continues on after the body. Well, ergo, energy neither being created nor destroyed, only transferred from one form to another. So who is to say that reincarnation is not real. And why would God, the most loving parent of all, condemn one of his or her children to an eternity of suffering when we keep getting chances to get it right and come back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everything in the universe seems to have a balance, as the laws of physics teach us. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. The Hindus and Buddhists believe in the law of karma. Everything that you do will come back to you or on you. And in the book of Galatians, it teaches that God will not be mocked. Whatever a man shall reap, so he shall sow. So this concept of balance and reincarnation and energy being recycled and returned is nothing new. It's just that now in the internet age, we are able to objectively analyze this and apply the scientific method to it.
Well, you and I kind of share a common background in that, though we went about it in different ways, my comparative religion studies went on for 15 years as I worked as a operations manager for a Christian radio station. And that was the most fascinating period of time for me, because a lot of the questions that we're talking about today came up, but I kept getting thrown back to the founding fathers of the faith, as they were called. Read their writings. They had these questions, and they have the answers. And two things came up is like, wait a minute, who set these guys up as the arbiters of the faith? And I don't even know half these guys' names. And I'm sitting here thinking these very questions. So does that make me, does that put me in that same category? You know, not that, you know, I care to be in that category, but it just, logic would dictate, well, gee, if an individual independent of knowledge of these individuals and their questions and answers starts asking the same questions, ergo, they become like these other gentlemen. But I always found it interesting when I came across certain individuals that I would interview of the Christian faith, how diverse their beliefs were from the doctrine and dogma and tradition that one was supposed to have.
Right.
And I thought, there is still hope for the world that we're not locked in.
Christ was an incredible progressive.
Yeah.
I mean, here he comes, and he was referred to as rabbi, so certainly he was a very pious Jew and very, very well educated. And one of the theories about Jesus' early years, we know that Herod the Great wanted all the children in his area, in the area that Jesus was born, put to death.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people just read that and gloss over it. When you look at who Herod the Great was, he married into his wife's family. Oh, he was an aristocrat, but he married into a royal family, and then had everyone in her family pretty much executed. Her brother was mysteriously drowned. Everybody else ended up strangled. He consolidated his power. He outmaneuvered the Roman general Pompey, outmaneuvered Julius Caesar to maintain his kingship, outmaneuvered Antony and Cleopatra, and then when they were defeated, went to Octavian Caesar and said, "Yes, I sided with Mark Antony against you, and I'm honest about that." And Octavian was so impressed with him, he kept him on the throne as a client king, puppet, if you will, of Rome.
Mm.
Now, all of a sudden, this group of astrologers, the three wise men, the Magi from Persia, come talking about the birth of a great king. And we could spend a whole episode just on what the Star of Bethlehem is, but for Cliff Notes' version, it was an astrological alignment as opposed to a Spielberg-esque spotlight, you know, Cecil B. DeMille effects, you know, zooming in on a particular spot. Because if that were the case, then Herod just would have gone and killed everybody there, because that was, you know, his thing.
Yeah.
But it was an astrological alignment. Long story short, because the court of Judea did not practice astrology, they were listening to what the Magi said. All right, Jesus was descended from the house of David through his mother Mary, ergo major political potential rival. And Herod, being a paranoid, genocidal, insecure, neurotic, well, of course he would have had all these people killed. Anyway, long story short, they flee to Egypt. We all know that. Then the next thing we hear is when he's 12, and then the next thing is when he's about 30 in ministry. Well, where in Egypt would they have gone? The largest and most affluent and intellectual city in the Mediterranean world was Alexandria, Egypt. Had over 1 million people in it. 20% of the population was Jewish, and it had the great library. Most likely, that would be where they would go. All right, a small Jewish family wafting into a couple hundred thousand Jewish folks. So Jesus was not some hick from the sticks like many want to portray them, but instead raised in the Manhattan of the day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He definitely spoke Hebrew, most likely Aramaic, had probably a working knowledge of Greek and was exposed to Latin. All right. Because I always look at Jesus as this incredible intellectual who then goes back to Judea and starts telling people about peace and love and understanding. And then comes up against the powers that be, and they don't want to hear that the Word of God is not just for a chosen group of people, but for everybody. What's all this peace and love and understanding stuff? And then Herod Antipas, just as paranoid as his father Herod the Great, oh no, not him again. just indulge me just for another minute. A lot of biblical scholars, you know, they go through the Bible and say Jesus probably didn't say that, probably did say this, but one area that they totally agree on is when Jesus is in the temple, it's just a few days before he died, and the Pharisees are there, there's Roman soldiers looking on, and they want to trap him, and there's an image of Caesar Tiberius, on the wall, and they're like, what should we do with this image? Now, the graven image is blasphemy,
right,
in Judaism. And here it is in the temple, and so the Romans are watching, and the Pharisees are watching, and there's a whole mob of people, oh, let's get him to say something bad about Caesar. And then Jesus turns around with the most Jesus of sayings, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but render unto God what is God's.
Mm-hmm.
Totally turns it right around on them, pa-boom, so they don't have their blasphemous statement that they can get all the Jewish folks riled up, and they don't have their treasonous statement, and the Romans are all itching to, you know. And it's just amazing how this enlightened being comes and starts preaching all this nonviolence. And I really like what Gandhi said. He said, I like you Christians. No, I like your Christ, but I don't like you Christians who don't act like your Christ. Because we see so many people saying, well, I'm a Christian, therefore that gives me the entitlement to pass judgment upon others. And true Christianity is about refraining from sitting in judgment of your fellow human brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And I don't recall Jesus saying, we're all the children of God, comma, except for the following people.
Exactly. By the way, I mean, if people thought about this quite logically, first of all, the name Christian, if I'm remembering correctly, was not used by the followers of Jesus. It was a slang. It was a F-word, if you will, used by non-believers, non-followers, towards these people, and they took it on, which I thought was rather interesting.
Yeah, it was. And Christianity did not become a Jewish thing.
But that's the other thing is Jesus was a Jew. He practiced Judaism. I mean, wasn't the Last Supper the Passover?
It was a Passover feast.
Ergo, and shouldn't we, if you and I, we were both raised Catholic, actually, we should be Jewish, following Jesus in that respect, you know, that kind of thing. That was what always struck me as funny.
The first time I attended a Passover dinner, I have a lot of Jewish friends, and they invited me, and I'm looking at this going, this is communion. Like, they got the unleavened bread. They got the wine. It's like, holy smokes. That's, you know, and it's like, duh. I mean, I knew that. But then seeing it and being part of it, it was like, wow. And I remember a friend of mine who was a priest, he celebrated communion at my house. And it was just maybe about 10 of us sitting around a table. It's like, well, this is what it was all about. It isn't this mass production thing, you know, but of course, you know, logistics being what they are, and so I have no problem, and I want all the listeners to understand, I have no problem with people of faith.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me if you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or pagan or Wiccan or whatever, as long as you don't use your faith as the us versus they syndrome. I'm right, everyone else is wrong, and those who are wrong are inferior. religion must never be used to justify anger, bigotry, hatred, or violence. And if you don't believe me, then read all of the great religious texts, because that's what all the great religious teachers were saying. We're all the children of God, and there's cultural differences among us, and ergo, that's where religions were created by human beings in an attempt to understand the infinity and the vast, everlasting love that is God.
Yeah. We're going to talk more about infinity in just a few moments. Eternity. Evidence of Eternity. Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer. Thepsychiclawyer.com is the website. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Tell Me Your Story is the program. Evidence of Eternity is our conversation piece, if you will. And Mark Anthony is our conversant, if you will. this, to me, is so fascinating because it brings up so many of the conversations that I have had over the, sounds strange to say, decades, that I have been searching. And I remember when I was working for this Christian station and I made the comment about how, I've been on my search since I was 17. And I was told, oh, well, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And I thought, no. Matter of fact, once I find Jesus, it's just begun. Because I had so many questions, I was so curious about some of the things that didn't make any sense to me. And you made a comment earlier in the program about why would a loving father condemn his creation to hellfire and brimstone? And that was the thing that the crux that really I just could not let go of for the longest. I kid you not, it took me 5 years in that environment to work through and reach a point where I never had to doubt my beliefs in regards to not believing in heaven and hell, in a physical, literal, if you will, or even spiritual devil, Satan, because I remember in conversations I've had with so many different rabbis, they would correct me when I would talk about this, and they would say that the references to the evil one, Satan and all Lucifer and all these different things. Granted, the stories, whether they be mythological or otherwise, about Lucifer being a fallen angel, all of this conversation over evil had to do with the lowest base nature of man. It wasn't external. It was all internal.
Yes.
And that...
yes,
go ahead.
I agree.
Go ahead.
Yes. I believe that it's the internal struggle between the ego-driven desires, and I like to call ego edging God out, because when you do something nasty or horrible to another human being, is it because you're acting out of pure love for them, or is it acting out of total self-centeredness for them?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give away the spoiler alert, but I do discuss this in depth in Evidence of Eternity,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
how people that become enlightened, it's putting aside material, me as center of the universe, desires for a greater understanding and a direct connect with God.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see these behaviors. I mean, if you look at Jesus, he put aside his regal bloodline and all of his skills that could have led him to become a great political figure. I mean, you know, with his abilities and intelligence and being a member of the House of David, he could have become a major political figure, possibly even usurping the Herod and the Maccabees, you know, the Herod family. And they certainly were aware of him and were paranoid of that. But when we start looking at what was hell, outside of Jerusalem, there's a valley known as Gehenna. And in Old Testament Bronze Age times, people who were criminals and people who could not afford a funeral, their bodies were burned in sulfur pits, which they called brimstone, ergo fire and brimstone. So it kind of became a thing in the Jewish culture that if you're bad and dishonored and lousy and rotten, you're going to end up there. as Christianity began to grow in the area, when the Greeks, when it appealed to the Greeks, then this Gehenna concept started morphing into it. Then there was two other influences. To the east in Persia, the Zoroastrian religion, which was the eternal struggle between light and dark, good and evil. And then, to put a anthropomorphized face on evil, the Nordic religions to the north of the Roman Empire, the god Loki. And Loki and Lucifer, interesting, names are very similar, gets incorporated in this, because Loki's this mischievous, demonic-type god who strikes down the young, heroic, beautiful god Baldur, who is resurrected after 3 days by his mother, Freya, and his father, Odin. Okay, so we start seeing a lot of parallels here. So when these concepts get incorporated into us, now it turns into Loki is Lucifer, who presides over this dark realm, which of course the Romans and the Greeks had with the god Hades. But Hades was not necessarily, or Pluto, depending on, you know, if it's Latin or Greek, was not necessarily an evil energy. It's like people had to die and they had to go somewhere, and that was his kingdom. But when the Christian world, and of course when Islam overwhelmed the area, they ate all the stuff up and loved the whole, you know, Christians and Muslims love hell and love the devil, like the whole idea of condemnation. Well, 300 years after Jesus dies and or is resurrected, the Roman Emperor Constantine orders a authoritative text for the new religion. So the Bible is formed and is put together. And there's the first version of it, more or less. And the imperial edict was that the Emperor of Rome, meaning Constantine, was God's vicegerent on earth and the equal of the apostles. And Jesus would return, and until he did, Constantine was his representative. Now, we know this is true because when the Roman Empire split into two and the western half collapsed, the eastern half, which existed in one form or another up till 1453 when the Turks overwhelmed it, the title of the Byzantine emperor to the very end was God's vicegerent on earth, the equal of the apostles. And of course, every king in Western Europe and every Muslim sultan and caliph and sheikh took this, I am here and I am the king or the ruler because of divine, this is where the divine authority of kings comes from. And if you look at early depictions of God, even up to Michelangelo, to the Renaissance, it's a very Constantine-looking character. The white imperial king sitting on the throne smiting people. So it worked in the Roman mindset that if you listened and obeyed the empire, you went to heaven, and if you didn't, you went to hell. And so this thought, this boogeyman that's going to get us has permeated religions. And I know this bends a lot of people out of shape, and they certainly are entitled to their opinion. And I'm not saying that evil does not exist, but we don't need some jerk with a pitchfork running around motivating us to commit evil. What happens is evil, the devil, is within us, and it's when you act on impulsive, self-centered, violent, lust-driven, all of those base level emotions where you're thinking only of yourself and not of anyone else. We don't need a devil to make us do bad things. We do bad things.
Yeah, take that, Flip Wilson.
Yeah, well, it's true. Flip Wilson, the devil made me do it. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The way he did, you know, and that's where all this comes from. So yeah, the devil does exist, but not in the sense that it's this, you know, lizard-like creature running around going, yeah, do this. It's when people really, really give in to their ego, and that's where they edge God out.
Yeah, exactly. And interesting that just a thought on my part has been, for example, God has also been akin to light. And I've often thought about this in the context of the whole ecological movement, you know, and the polluting of the water, polluting of the air and the land and on and on and on. And then I got to thinking about that more on a spiritual level. And I thought, you know what? You can't pollute light. You either block it in terms of creating shadows, or you don't. but it is always moving. But light is also energy. And then you made the statement earlier in terms of what was it, the third law of thermodynamics, having to do with energy, that it never disappears. It just is transformed and transmuted. And I find that what is so fascinating in terms of watching various documentaries and talking with different people about whether it be the sciences that, let's say, an individual like in our modern times, a Tesla, who supposedly had discovered ways of extracting, if you will, or maybe the better word is transmuting or transforming energy into a usable resource for man. That again, it's just transmuted. It's not, it doesn't disappear in the context that we think in terms of its, after it's been used, it's still there. It's just in a different form. And even down through the centuries, you know, different discoverers, if you will. I always find that fascinating when I hear someone say, oh, well, I invented thus and such. No, you just discovered it.
You know? Right.
It's always been there. I love I think it's from the Psalms. I know it's the Old Testament, but I can't remember if it's in the Psalms having to do with there's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new has been said. Nothing new has been done. It's just a different form. It's like trans. I was watching a thing on the Wright brothers just this Sunday in terms of, I guess, their anniversary coming up. And I thought, well, yeah, that's great that, you know, man now can, quote unquote, fly. But what's it used for? Getting from point A to point B, a little faster, a little more creatively, but still it's just getting from point A to point B. Now, there are some who would say, well, yeah, but, you know, let's say hang gliders. They love being up there and just soaring around. Hey, I would love to be a bird, too, you know. But it's fascinating to me just the so many different aspects to the life that we've been given, the things that we can do. And yet, what do? We create all of these beliefs because, again, we're created. These doctrines, these dogmas, regardless of religion, and you and I are on the same page in terms of, you know, I have, you know, I say all of this with no disrespect, with great reverence and respect for the various religions, great and small, on the planet, that what we're trying to do is open the doors a little bit, not just to understanding of one another, but understanding of where some of these beliefs came from, so that, as Greg Braden has said, we can transform from belief to knowing. That's the real transformation, if you will, for us, to let go of the mythology. Let go. I mean, the stories are great. They've got great. They have great moral and messages.
And they all and people learn by parables.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly right about that, Richard. When you look at how did Jesus teach? How did Buddha teach?
Yes.
They told stories,
yes,
like the Good Samaritan, the seven wise and foolish bridesmaids, the prodigal son. When you start looking at that, well, who was Jesus teaching to? Largely illiterate people.
Yeah.
And so if you sit down and go, well, the scripture says this, da-da-da-da-da-da, as opposed to, well, there was a man who had two sons. And then they could think about that and relate to that. And even when you look in it, medieval morality plays, most people don't realize this, but when you put up a nativity scene in your house, and I do, okay, I do. It's something I like,
mm-hmm,
something my mother did, my grandmother did. You know, it just gives me a sense of family and continuity. Well, the nativity scene, as we know it, was invented by St. Francis of Assisi in the early, I believe it was 1100s, because he was teaching a group of people in central Italy about the birth of Christ, and so he put together a play. And he had a young couple with a baby, and he had some people dress up as wise men, and they had shepherds and all this. And he described this to people and demonstrated it to them. Well, you know, being Italian, I can say this. Italians being Italians are watching this going, you know, we can make us some money off of this. Let them make a little statues and sell them. And so they did, and then it became a whole industry. And it's funny because people say, well, this is how it was. And it's like, well, that's how St. Francis depicted it 1,200 years after Jesus,
mm-hmm,
born.
Yeah.
But it was a story that brought it to life for people. So I don't have a problem with these stories bringing things to life for people, because if you look at the Old Testament, particularly when you start examining the translations for the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls were a first century A.D. version of Old Testament events, which were 800 years plus earlier. Okay, mm-hmm. So you still have, you know, 8 centuries is 8 centuries, and no language stays static. Okay, but there's some pretty racy stuff in it. One of the things that biblical scholars were just shocked is Abraham's wife Sarah.
Yeah.
Talking about her shapely breasts.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the version of the Bible that I read didn't talk about how hot Sarah was.
Yeah.
Okay. And because people are sexually driven, they're lustful, they're licentious, they're driven by anger and rage and human emotions, and the Old Testament is about a lot of that. And what Jesus was explaining is how to overcome that is letting go of the ego and connecting with the spirit, with the love that is God.
Yeah.
Buddha, very much the same thing. He also being a prince of a royal bloodline. So that's a very good point that you're making, and how these stories bring it home for people. But then there's people, in fact, I was watching The Big Bang Theory the other night. This one cracked me up. You know, Sheldon, everyone knows Sheldon. Jim Parsons does a great job with that. And his mother comes, and she's a born-again Christian from East Texas. And he's talking about this paper that he and Leonard wrote where they won an award for, and it's about a quantum singularity, and da-da-da-da, and he's going off this whole thing. And she says, "So, you can believe that, but you can't believe that God lined up animals 2 by 2 and led them into the ark." And Sheldon replies, "What did they feed the lions, mother?" And she replies, "The floating bodies of drowned sinners."
There you go. And it makes logical sense. That's funny. You know, it's interesting, too, that you bring this up, because I remember when I was getting into conversations with people about the origins of the Bible, for example, I would ask, okay, so can I see a list of criterion that determine what would become canonical and non-canonical, what would become apocryphal, and so forth? And I was sort of given an outline. But I remember reading a book in regards to this, and that there was one book in the Old Testament that didn't fit, but it was still in the canon of Scripture. And I'm going, wait a minute. If it doesn't fit, no, I'm not going there. If it doesn't fit, then why is it? You know where I was going to go.
If it doesn't fit, you must omit.
That's exactly. And it was the Song of Solomon. And I've read Song of Solomon many times. And based upon the criterion, one of the criterion was that it had to make references to God, the Father. It had to make references to the, I don't know, the Trinity or... But nowhere, the Song of Solomon is about sex. It's about love. It's about intimate relations, and again, I was just beside myself. I guess maybe I still am, with what I thought at the time was righteous indignation. Going, wait a minute, you can't have it both ways. You can't say the believers must adhere to these 66 books. But this one right here in the middle of the Old Testament doesn't fit, but we're going to leave it in anyway. And I'm going, then why didn't you leave the other 12 or 14 or 22, what have you, in there also? And I began to understand from a political standpoint why. Because those other books, and I have a copy of the Lost Books of Eden and the Forgotten, I think that's the title of it anyway, and another, like the Gospel of St. Thomas and so on and so forth,
right,
that they flew in the face of the power that the church was trying to exert at the time to control the people. I still remember the story someone told me, for example, about the church going about collecting alms, telling the people if they didn't give alms, God would cover the sun. He would take away the light. Well, they also knew from their astronomers that an eclipse was coming.
Yes.
And so they would, and as the sun darkened, the people gave and gave and gave, and then the sun lightened again. and they were saved. Because just as you stated, even in Jesus' day, if not after, for 5,000 or 500 or 1,000 years, they were dealing with ignorant people, and that's why they kept them ignorant. And in a manner of speaking, to this day, the powers that be they religious or political, are basically trying to do the same thing. Keep the
knowledge is power.
Exactly.
Knowledge is power. Michael Crichton wrote a very interesting book, which they made into a movie that I wasn't real thrilled with, but it was about this Muslim emissary. I believe he was to Russia anyway. He got kidnapped by Vikings.
Hmm.
And it's actually based on, there were some records found in some archives, I believe, in Baghdad. So this is somewhat based on a true story. And the Vikings took him all the way up to, I don't know, either Finland or Denmark, and they were at war with this ape-like race. Long story short, Crichton put forth the theory that there may have been pockets of Neanderthals in remote regions of Scandinavia as early as like the 8th or 9th centuries.
Wow.
Which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
And that the Vikings were at war with them, and then the question came, well, what happened to the Neanderthals? And Michael Crichton said, the next time you're in public, look around and see if you can spot the people with more of a Neanderthal DNA than people with a Cro-Magnon DNA. And this isn't a racist thing. You know, he said that maybe Neanderthals didn't so much go extinct as they sort of interbred. Because paleontologists are beginning to say that with what they found with Neanderthals, they're not quite the brainless brutes that were once thought.
Mm.
And so in that case, the Vikings would have had perhaps the superior intellect and the better weapons. And if you look throughout history, I mean, who ran ancient Egypt? Not only the pharaoh, but the scribes, the people that could read or write.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly has carried itself on. Now we're in a society where the vast, vast majority of people are capable of reading and writing. And so it isn't quite as easy to assert dominance the way it once was.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, concepts, a bizarre concept like freedom of speech
yeah.
arose
yeah.
in the Reformation and the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
So I think it's fascinating how these things are evolving. And that's why more people are turning away from their belief systems now than ever before in history. In other words, Christianity is declining in the United States and Western Europe because a lot of people simply don't believe the parables and the stories, but that doesn't mean they're turning their backs on God. That's when you go and you talk to people and say, well, what faith are you? Well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual.
Yeah.
And you're hearing that more and more. And I'm not saying that this is good or this is bad. I'm just saying that this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
there's another religion which is growing by leaps and bounds, but I'm not going to comment upon that. But a lot of people are now saying, I want to believe in God, but I can't necessarily believe in this restrained and limited perception of God.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that actually brings me to... and I should let our listeners know, again, we're talking with Mark Anthony. He's the author of Evidence of Eternity. Website is thepsychiclawyer.com. By the way, The Evidence of Eternity is communicating with spirits for proof of the afterlife. And my question for you at this particular juncture is, from all that you have researched over the years that has culminated certainly in this book in particular, from your perspective, what is eternity?
That's a fascinating question. And try to think of always was and always will be. World without end.
Amen.
Universe is expanding into what? Mm. And it became very clear to me over years and years of research and with in-depth discussions with psychologists and psychiatrists and neurosurgeons and neurobiologists about the structure of the human brain, we cannot comprehend infinity. it doesn't mean we don't know it's there. It's like you and I, you know, we walk into a room and we'll flip on a light switch and da-da, there's lights. But do you really know what electricity is? What is it?
Yeah.
We're aware of it, but we don't really know what it is.
You can't put it on a slide and look at it under a telescope or microscope.
Exactly. And it's the same thing with infinity. And in Evidence of Eternity, I explain that we are finite material world beings. In other words, we are like a bottle, and our infinite immortal spirit is in that bottle, and the human brain is the cork in the bottle. So ergo, it is the arbiter between the finite and the infinite. We come into this experience, and this relates to your earlier question about reincarnation and contracts before we're born. There are things that we can experience while living in the material world that you simply cannot when you're in an infinite and immortal state. And that may be, that very well may be why we come into this life, to experience the pain and suffering and the limited experiences that we can, because there is purpose in those and there is knowledge and experience to be gained in those. And let me tell you, for those of you who are suffering with the loss of a loved one, it's really hard at times to think that living in this life is a privilege. I mean, there's a lot of days that, I don't feel that being here is a privilege, but it is in the bigger sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what we tend to do is, in our attempt to understand the infinite, we'll put a finite face in it. And that's why many people see God as Jesus or Vishnu or Shiva or Buddha or Great Spirit or, the Kami any other type of deity. And it's not that they're doing anything wrong. In fact, they're doing everything right in the human experience, because our brain is incapable of comprehending infinity. Because everything that we know and we experience has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when you look at the great theoretical physicists, with Einstein, Feynman, Tesla, Stephen Hawking, time is timeless. Everything that has happened, will happen, and is happening is all occurring energetically at the same time. Whoa, our brain can't grasp that.
Yeah.
We think we're born. We move in one direction as we grow old, and then we die. And so we create the ability, a point of reference that we can relate to. It's very easy to relate to Jesus as God, a loving Savior imbued with all these mystical, incredible powers and wisdom and all the answers. And maybe he is God. Maybe he was an incarnation of God on earth. I'm not saying that he isn't. That's for an individual to decide in his or her own heart.
Yeah.
Perhaps Krishna was God who walked upon earth, and that is not for me to decide. That's for the individual person of that belief system to decide, and we can go on and on with that.
Sure.
So that is my Cliff Notes quick way of trying to understand infinity. We can't really understand it or comprehend it, but that does not mean we do not realize and know that it is there.
It's kind of like the same knowing that I have had about my life's existence and the fact that it has meaning. I don't know why it has meaning. I just know that it does. That I know that I cannot spend my life raping, pillaging, and plundering like the Vikings, because I have something else that I'm supposed to be doing. And I mean, that's all I can say. And that was the other thing that I found so fascinating as I got close to my graduation from Christian broadcasting, was that I could not sit and debate and argue belief with someone. I would lose every time, because you just can't, because a person's belief is just that. Although I used to question the logic behind some of the positions taken, especially when they would start using facts like quote-unquote evidence of, let's just say, because you brought it up earlier about Noah's Ark, the evidence of Noah's Ark up on Mount Ararat. And I'm going, well, but wait a minute. If you accept that fact, that evidence, to support your belief, then it's not belief anymore. And that's sort of the transition that we're talking about in terms of going from belief to knowledge, to knowing. And you and I, it feels a little bit like we are sort of cut from somewhat the same cloth of curiosity and intrigue about all of this. I'm quite intrigued by your body of knowledge that you have gathered, if you will, in terms of your understanding as well as your ability to collate and correlate all of the different religions and their similarities. I mean, we could sit here and talk about the differences, but what I'm hearing not only from you but from others is it is the similarities that if we would just start to see them, it's what's going to bring us together. It's what's going to stop a lot of the silliness that's going on around the world and on the planet and so forth.
Well,
and
I think George Harrison, I always loved George Harrison. Mm. And even though the Beatles were before my time, I always followed his solo career. And I remember there was a quote he said in an interview that all religions are branches of one big tree, and it doesn't matter what you call God, just so long as you call.
Just call. Exactly. Exactly. That's very good. I like that. Another one I was thinking of, because I just happened to be watching this one program where they used the line in regards to becoming a member of a particular club or organization or even organized religion. I believe the quote is from Mark Twain, who said that he would never be a member of thus and such organization if they had him as a member. You know,
it was Groucho Marx.
It was Groucho Marx. That's
Groucho
right. Thank
Marx.
You.
I'd never join a club that had me as a member.
That's, and that's, it's like, wait a minute. You want me? No, thank you. I'm out of here.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. He was, when he was doing his television show, You Bet Your Life, mm-hmm. he was in an elevator in an office building in L.A., and there was a Baptist minister walking with him. He goes, Groucho, I just want to thank you for all the fun you've brought into the world. And Groucho shot back, and I want to thank you for all the fun you've taken out of it.
Just so many great quotes out there by so many wonderful people, him included. I'm curious, before we wrap up, I have three questions. This is not one of them that I'm going to ask you. But I'm curious as to how this investigation, if you will, and research, how this has changed you?
Immensely. I've always, I grew up, even though I grew up in a Catholic household, both of my parents were psychic mediums.
Really?
They didn't practice it, yes.
Wow.
This is a recessive trait that runs on both sides of my family. And my family, the Italian side of it, was featured recently on the PBS special, The Italian Americans. And in my new book, I write about my great-grandmother, Giovanna, who was just an amazing psychic medium and very reverential person. And just exploring my own family background and the prejudice and hatred that's been cast at us because of our abilities. But I grew up in a family that even though, you know, we believed in God, we believed in Jesus, we never let religion get in the way of God. And my mother would talk about saints and avatars and Jesus and Buddha in the same discussion. And so writing my first book, Never Letting Go, put me on the path of this quest, which Evidence of Eternity has just been the reception to it. I mean, within 10 days, it was completely sold out nationwide. It's in a second and even larger printing, and I believe it's going into a third now. It's only been out 2 months. And it has changed me because it's getting me to look at the world in a much, much kinder way. I actually do think there's hope for us. And one quote in Evidence of Eternity that's getting a lot of traction is that God exists in spite of religion, not because of religion.
I love that. I love that. Matter of fact, it's interesting that two individuals that I can think of, one of them I'm sure you're familiar with, Edgar Cayce.
Oh, very much so.
Fought his gift, his ability, I think, right to his dying day. And I've read all of the books and so forth. But there was another gentleman whose book, sadly, I wish I still had the original copy. I do have a copy of the book. Johannes Graeber, Communication with the Spirit World of God. And he was a Catholic who got caught up in channeling. And the information was more directed at the Catholic Church and Catholicism than anything else. But nonetheless, there was still some very good stuff in there. And he lived about the same time as Edgar Cayce. And I found it so fascinating that in spite of their individual beliefs, because Johannes Graeber was a priest in the Catholic Church, that they still persisted and pursued these, I'll call them again, gifts. And I found that so fascinating that these gentlemen and others like them did that. And you have obviously, you know, you've expanded your awareness, your consciousness in that regard, so that you're able to basically do the same thing, although you're not fighting your beliefs, because it sounds to me as though you have, they've grown and evolved with you and your search and investigation.
I believe in God. To paraphrase Greg Braden, I know God exists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do I completely or even close to marginally understand the enormity that is God? Let's look at how the Hindus look at it. When you look into the eyes of someone you love who truly loves you back, you're catching a glimpse of God.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I like that. Before we wrap up, again, the title of the book is Evidence of Eternity, Communicating with Spirits for Proof of the Afterlife. Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer, thepsychiclawyer.com is the website. And Mark, first question of the three, who is Mark Anthony?
Man on a mission to prove that God exists. Heaven exists. Our soul is an immortal living spirit. We can communicate with those souls, and when it is our time to leave the material world, we will be reunited with our loved ones in the light and love that is God.
Hmm. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
To open minds to the reality of the existence of God.
And who inspires you?
I would have to say that my inspiration comes from Jesus, from Buddha, from Gandhi, and from the greatest spiritual teacher I have ever known, my mother, who was born with the gift of psychic ability and mediumistic ability, and who used it to help so many people in so many ways.
Hmm. I want to thank you so much for taking this time to share with us. There was one other example I was thinking of in regards to reincarnation that was in the metaphysical primer, if you will, of my search back at the age of 17. Paramahansa Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, where he talks about his friend Kashi, who dies, and he makes a promise to him that he will find him, and he did. And it's an interesting story. You have to pick up a copy of the book to look at it. But I just find this conversation that we've had today exhilarating and fascinating. And I thank you for your time. And if you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to continue this conversation in studio.
Oh, thank you. I'm hoping, I was just in L.A. last week, and I'm hoping to be back in the next month or two. So I look forward to meeting you.
That'd be great. Again, Mark Anthony's my guest, Evidence of Eternity, Communicating with Spirits for Proof of the Afterlife, and that is the title of the book we've been talking about, among other things, and the website is thepsychiclawyer.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.